Hello, and welcome to this edition of Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River in Columbia. This is PPTS, presented as a service to the progressive community by the Coffee Party USA Radio Network. PPTS highlights the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement. Join our host and special guests as we discuss the most interesting and important topics of the day. If you have a cause, an issue, a campaign, or candidacy that you're actively engaged with, please feel free to give us a call at 646-929-2495 and share with us your question or comment. Join the show's co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, in our lively chat. Go to the bottom of this episode page, sign into the chat room, and let us know what you are doing about it. All opinions are welcome. For the Coffee Party USA and Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, welcome to today's show. Please make welcome our host and friend, the Tennessee Progressive.
Well, howdy, neighbor. Welcome to our show today. Come on up and sit on the porch. Let's talk a spell. Coming to you live from south and slightly left of Nashville, Tennessee, along the Mighty Duck River, I am the Tennessee Progressive. Welcome to our show with Progressive Patty and our whole gang as we will spend the next 2 hours together talking about the battle on hunger and the war on the poor. That is our topic today. We need your input. We're looking for field reports from the battlefield on hunger, and we're going to reprise this edition later this week. So anything that you can tell us or that you want to get out in your activities on the war on the poor or the battle on hunger or the hunger cliff that you want the nation to know about, this is the place to do it, and this is the way to do it. You can call us at our radio call-in number. Talk to us about why it is you think that the war on the poor or the battle on hunger is having such a dramatic effect on American citizens. Our number is area code 646-929-2495. I am the Tennessee Progressive, and we look forward to listening to your calls. You can also join us by going to the bottom of the episode page for today, which is episode 7 of season 2, and it's titled PPTS S2E7, season 2, episode 7, War on the Poor. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about each of the 8 battles that we think that are most dramatically impacted by this war on the poor. And we're going to talk about the results of what we've discovered or learned or remembered about the battle of hunger. Especially important that we do that this week, given all the things that have happened specifically in the war on the poor this week, as we prepare for this, the beginning of holiday week that will include Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and go all the way to Cyber Monday. So we want you to understand that these things that we've been talking about in the vapor of possibility over the last few months, off and on, is now becoming a reality that American citizens are going to face in a very hard way come about, say, the 28th of this month. There are approximately 147 million Americans who are not certain that given the option of celebrating this holiday, they will be able to provide the things that are traditional to this holiday, like, for instance, a turkey or stuffing or mashed potatoes or a table inside place to celebrate. And it is in their name and in their cause that we are on these airwaves. This is presented to you as a live service by Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, Coffee Party USA, and the NetRoots Radio Network. We are here to talk today about the war on the poor. Now, we can talk about it in May and in April and in September, and we worry for different reasons. And what we worry about this time are those who don't have the opportunity to enjoy the holiday, specifically as a holiday, because they're too busy worrying about their family survival. Now, we've had some things come to pass this week that we haven't seen before in the battle on hunger and the battle on the income and the war on the poor. We've seen big box stores and department stores and all kinds of retail entities brag about the fact that they're going to be working on Thanksgiving. Well, we want to talk about that today. We want to talk about the one that got me the most personally and why, and then we're going to run down a list of those who are so proud of their enslavement of their employees that they're forcing them to work on Thanksgiving at the risk of losing their jobs. Because they all know we're going to run out after pumpkin pie and go buy staples and office supplies, I guess. because, I don't know, it's just a thing to do on Thanksgiving. But the other side of that is there are going to be employees in those stores, whether we're there or not. I will tell you, Thanksgiving night in my house includes football. It does not include shopping. It's a time for my family to get together and those people that I love to spend time together playing games, trimming trees, dressing up animals, and if we're real lucky, having a snowball fight. But it does not include visiting your local retail big box store, and it never will. That's as in never. I have a lot to be thankful for, and it takes a long time to celebrate it. Sometimes it's the only time of the year when everybody that I care about can be together in the same place because they too have lives that they struggle with, that are filled with their own sets of difficulties and dilemmas. And the things of everyday living have gotten, you know, on this end of the battle, very difficult. So when we get a chance to be together, we get together. We plan it in advance to the exclusion of all other things, and that's the way that goes. So if you're one of the 147 million Americans who aren't exactly certain that you're going to have the opportunity to have those moments, then we'd like to talk to you today. We'd like to hear your story. We'd like you to call us and tell us about the story that you would want the American people to know. And we look forward to hearing your story because we consider it to be very important. Now, we've talked about, generally, you've heard on the Coffee Party Radio Sunday show for PPTS, over the last 3 weeks, we've been very singularly focused on the battle over hunger, the hunger cliff, the battle over food security, which is part of the war on the poor. And there are some things that we've learned that perhaps we did not know before. If you've listened to episodes of other shows on the Coffee Party Network over the last 2-3 weeks, you also know that that show, many of our shows, have dealt with the hunger cliff and the war on the poor. So if you want to give us a call at area code 646-929-2495, you'll be connected with our co-host and producer, Progressive Patty, and she will get you on the air with me as soon as possible. Blogs across the blogosphere this week have been talking nonstop about the events that have been going on that directly affect the battle and the war. There's a difference between the battle for hunger and the war on the poor. We've identified 8 different battlefields that are involved directly in the war on the poor. And the first battlefield we've looked at has been the battle of hunger. And we found out that hunger tends to, of course, involve other battlefields as well. And those battlefields have come up in arguments before our Congress in the last 2 weeks. And if you want to understand the battle, okay, but you've got to understand that the battle is an indigenous part of a war. It's a smaller focused area of influence. Not only are we going to, but we're also going to, and they say that 8 times that we've identified as major battles in the war on the poor. And no, I'm not going to give you all 8 of them today because I want you to understand the war from a battle perspective. This starts with the notion that the best field general, commanding general, isn't on the ground. He's on a mountain overlooking the battlefield so that he can see what's happening in any particular area of the battlefield at any given moment. We want to identify those areas of the battlefield, but we want to do them in an isolated way because that's the way they do it in the military, I guess. But, you know, if you don't understand what the battle for hunger is, how are you going to know when you're making progress or when you're having to suffer a setback? Well, okay, if you're on the ground and you're hungry, you know it. But how do we, who are observing or who are trying to defend, know it? You know, hunger is a very personal issue. Even within a family, somebody can be hungry and not know it. I said that wrong. Some member of your family can be hungry and you won't know it. Now, there are many, many millions of kids in this country who are hungry right now. And that is not to say that their parents do or don't know it. It's that we don't know it. Because a lot of that happens under a roof where there is no observation available. We see the results of it when the kid comes to school the next day and is not prepared to study because they're so hungry they can't concentrate on anything but food. We've talked to specialists who tell us that when a hungry child comes to school, a child especially who is persistently hungry, they only think of food. And when teachers are trying to motivate and release the intelligence and turn on the light bulb for these students, they can't get through it. And the reason they can't get through is because of the focus and the attention the child has on being hungry. They start dreaming and daydreaming in terms of food. As we heard one child say, when she's going to school, she's so hungry that all she can do is think of food. Actually, what she said was think of fruit. And when she saw her teacher, she saw a banana. How do you break through with reading, writing, arithmetic when you cannot focus on anything but your own hunger? That hunger leads to lack of sleep, obvious lack of nutrition, lack of health. We see instances of psychological problems, physical problems, emotional problems, intellectual problems. All of these greet the teacher at the schoolroom door on Tuesday when the child comes in hungry. This is a sign of hunger. The grades that the child makes can become, over time, a signal of the effectiveness of education. And if a teacher has a room full of hungry kids, her net result is going to be not so great, unless she can tap through and deal first with the battle of hunger before she can deal with the battle of education. And we are setting our teachers up to fail in this way because we are not providing for the needs of the least among us when it comes to the area of nutrition and the availability of reasonable food. That's one of the ways that the battle of hunger affects the entire battlefield on the war on the poor. And as we have also seen, those numbers involved in the battle on hunger have grown. Not only the number of victims of hunger, but those who are arrayed against those victims of hunger. And what we see are the beginning of two sides of a battle that's ongoing. And it's important for us as progressives to understand what each side of the battle is dealing with, so that we may positively address, first of all, our role to defend the defenseless. And secondly, to come against those who are waging war against the poor, especially when it comes to the needs of the hungry, and say, no. We can foretell future events if we understand the battle. We can begin to anticipate what those arrayed against the poor will do next, because we have on our team some of the most intelligent, educated people, particular battle, that you can possibly have. They have written papers, they come on our show and talk to us, and they tell us that you can expect that if this happens, the result will be this, it will affect the hungry in this way, to this extent, and then we will have to deal with that. For instance, we know that the stimulus that President Bush provided for the SNAP program expired on November 1st. We know that as a result of that, some $5 billion, that's B, was cut immediately from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That wasn't something that was going to happen next September or December. It happened November 1st. So when those people who are on the SNAP program got their cards recharged on November 1st, there was an average of $36 less per card. That's how quickly it happened. Now, what that does is it lowers the total of the SNAP benefit that that cardholder is eligible for. And it's based upon the number of mouths that card is supposed to help feed. On October 31st, the average amount per mouth per month was a little over $83. Now, I'll let you do the math and divide that by 30 days and then divide that by 3 meals. Don't look shocked when I tell you the number. Be offended when you tell yourself the number. There is another change that is scheduled to happen on January 1st. That will take an additional $5 billion out of the SNAP program. As it stands and has nothing to do with the Farm Bill, has nothing to do with SNAP, it has to do with the sequestration bill. And the sequestration bill will cut again because, you see, sequestration began in 2013, but all of the cuts to that part of the sequestration bill that were to become effective in 2013 have not yet completely hit, because some of the areas of government in sequestration have not yet felt their cut, their slow pay, their future contracts. There's all kinds of things that don't require the expenditure of money in 2013, but will demand money in 2014. That's before the 2014 sequestration itself. So 2013 is going to be building through 2014 along with the 2014 build sequestration and the emergency fund coverage, the emergency reorganization of budgets and stuff like that, that made it possible for many programs to continue at their current levels in 2013 will not be available in 2014. And the 2013 cuts will finally hit those agencies and departments of government, and they will hit as well. It is going to be a compound growing problem at every area of government. Okay? That includes the Farm Bill, which is a budget for the Department of Agriculture, which has not come yet out of the Senate. One of the primary reasons that it has not come out of the Senate is because of an intent by the conservative Republicans, Paul Ryan, his group, to not cut the SNAP program, but to eliminate it. And if they had their way, the bill that they would propose would eliminate the SNAP program. It wouldn't cut $4 or $5 billion. It would cut $40 billion out of that program. Incidentally, it would do so while not doing the first thing about farm subsidies. In fact, it would raise farm subsidies. Farm subsidies are monies that are paid by the government to farmers to help them survive. While their crops, it helps them pay for crop seeds and all kinds of the entire production process to help them survive until the crops come due so they can get paid, repay their loans, and survive. Unfortunately, the largest percentage of the farm subsidies go to three companies. The three largest agribusinesses in America receive 85% of the farm subsidies. And that means, first of all, that the small farmer, the family farmer, has 15% of those subsidies to spread among them all, while their competition, large corporate agribusiness, is subsidized at 85% of the total, who have seen multi-billion dollar per quarter profits. Why are we subsidizing profit-making individuals? Profit means after all their costs, they have money left over. And, of course, they get these farm subsidies, but they add to their profit. If you took away the farm subsidies, they would be left with their profit. So, meanwhile, back at the home farm, you got 15% of the total subsidy to go around between hundreds of thousands of small farmers who are underwater, who cannot see a profit at the end of their cycle. All they're doing is losing less money. Some of the farm subsidies are paid to small farmers who do rotational farming, which means that one-third of their farm may well be fallow because they're trying to re-enrich that land. They're trying to be responsible landowners. And the government pays them a subsidy that helps pay for the crops that would have been grown on that land to keep them in full production, to give them a chance to have a profit. That's educated farming. That's the way educated farmers do things when you're on a small family farm. And large agribusiness tends not to do that. They tend to run their land into nothingness. They will produce 100% of their farms at every level. And even then, the small farmer can't compete. The difficulty with the agribusiness at the small farm level is destroying the small farm, has been for a long time. One of the reasons that the small farm is being destroyed has to do with farm subsidies. Now, while we want to believe that these dollars are being spent to the local farmer, they're not. 85 cents out of every dollar is going to one of three huge agribusinesses. If they want to cut subsidy, they can't because the lobby is too strong. There is no lobby for the small farmer. How does this affect the war on the poor? Well, it becomes obvious. You're subsidizing the top 1% of the farming industry, who absolutely does not require it in order to make a reasonable profit. The reason they're being subsidized at the levels they're being subsidized is because of the lobby, which goes before the committee and says ConAgra must have their subsidies. And nobody asked the question why. There's no one on that committee that is strong enough to say, what about Joe Farmer, the guy whose kids are moving off the farm and won't come back home to farm because they're not willing to put themselves in voluntary servitude to ConAgra? Because ConAgra will go to the small farmer and say, we'll buy your products, we'll buy your crops, you're out, but you can't own your land. You have to trade us your land for your crops. And they become sharecroppers on their own land. I know this from personal experience. Therefore, the small farmer doesn't even have the ability to feed his own family. There is no position worse than an agricultural farmer, production farmer, who cannot feed his own family. But they, too, are in this mix. They have fewer crops to send to market. And I'm not talking about to the ConAgra silos. I'm talking about to the local farmers market, where an awful lot of people do an awful lot of business an awful lot of the time to get fresh produce, fruits and vegetables, for their tables. They're not there. They can't participate because they don't have the crops, because they can't afford the coverage between the time they plant the seeds and the yield is available to survive. The reason for that is because of the subsidies they're not getting. We learned that the number I use is actually wrong, but it's not so wrong as to be uninstructive, so I continue using the number of 8 million in the number of families that are living in cars who do not have a permanent home address. I've seen them try to use their license plates as an address, and that's been kicked out and they'll use the address of a local shelter who cannot confirm them as being residents of that shelter. They'll use a physical address of, 100 East Main Street for the shelter address as their permanent address. But then that has to be verified, and the shelter can't verify their address because they're not in the shelter. And even that is a bit of a problem because in most municipalities, employers know, have a record of the address of shelters. And they put those addresses on a blacklist and say that if someone comes and reports this as their permanent address, they're unemployable to us. We will not hire them. Therefore, these folks have zero income. One of the results happens because if you don't have a permanent address, you lose your ability to plug into the resources that are available to make your situation better, whether it be public housing, whether it be SNAP, whether it be vouchers for the Salvation Army so your kids can get a winter coat or winter shoes. None of that's available if you don't have a permanent address. Further, you don't have a resulting availability to the semi-nutritious meals you can get at a shelter. Therefore, your local food resource becomes McDonald's. Because, first of all, while it is the most expensive meal you could buy, it's the one that allows you to stay in presence inside longest. And when it's cold outside, being inside counts. And when I tell you that 8 million Americans are living in cars, that doesn't mean that they have heat. It means that they have a car. But who can afford the fuel? Of course, sleeping in cars can be very dangerous. As any emergency room physician will tell you as they see the ongoing case of carbon monoxide poisoning in children. Coffee Party says we can have conversation across both sides of the aisles using civility if our intent is to walk away having made a positive difference from the conversation. I don't want to represent anyone. That's not the purpose of Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. We give the activists, the activism, and the activities of the progressive movement across the United States a place to be voiced. And if you have a movement, if you have a cause, if you have an action, if you have a candidate or a candidacy, we want you to come here and tell us about it. If you have a particular view on the battle of hunger, whether it be, you think that those people should just get out there and get on their bootstraps and find a job and, by God, make it on their own, tell us about it. If you're one of those people that are in the 147 million Americans today who have food insecurity, we'd like to hear from you so that we can know your story. And you can call us at 646-929-2495, and we'll be glad to listen to your story. If you want to give us your opinion, that's fine. Let us know what your opinion. Put a big box around it. We'll let it rip. We'll let you say whatever you want to say. If you come on representing yourself as an authority on an issue, or you know for a fact that this or that, come prepared. Have your proof with you, because we will certainly have ours. And we want to have a talk on this war on the poor, because, first of all, we're going to focus away from it for a while by going to another battlefield. And we don't want to leave this area without having some sense of the reality that we've set out before us as being valid. If you believe that our representation of this battle of the hunger and the hunger cliff is accurate, we'd like to hear from you. If you believe it's inaccurate, we'd like to hear from you. And you can do that right now for the next hour and 30 minutes. So if there's a way that either PPTS, the show, or the Coffee Party can become actively engaged in your position, we would like to do that. If the Farm Bill were to come out without any further cuts to SNAP, but with significant cuts to subsidies, we'd be in favor of that. Now, there are those who would call that redistribution of wealth. Okay, I'm not at all opposed to that if that's the result. If that's the result that the small farmer gets the ability to survive, and the three largest corporations in the agribusiness take a little bit of a haircut that they're not going to lose anything from anyway. With me, that's perfectly acceptable, because that means that there are tens of millions of Americans that will not be hungry because they don't have the ability financially to weather the storm between the time the seeds are planted and the time the crops are harvested. Also means there's a likely chance that when the crops are harvested, they will bring a little bit better price, because the prices are not as controlled by the three big companies as they were last season. I'm in favor of that. Now, I know that there are breadbasket states that wouldn't like to hear that at all because of the fact that these three large these conglomerations employ a very large number of people. I understand that. But I want to find out that there's equal employment, not what's the word I'm looking for, not predatory employment. And I've seen it where, one of these big three will go into an area and say, listen, we are here. We're going to be here. We will employ you. If you don't employ us, your crops will not go to market. And that is our purpose. Our purpose is to control your market. When asked why, the inevitable answer coming from the three largest agricultural commodity conglomerates in the world, say because we can't. I believe that's the wrong answer. As a progressive, I believe that is a wrong environment. I don't believe that's good corporate citizenship. I don't believe that it's reasonable. Now, okay, they say it will, you know, the price is what the market will bear. But the price that's being paid has nothing to do with what the market will bear. And I would like to see a little equality there, too. How does the small guy compete with a large guy? Well, historically, we know not well. That doesn't mean they shouldn't have the opportunity to at least compete. And if they can't compete, what you have is a monopoly. And a monopoly says that no matter what the little guy does, the big guy wins, which means that the little guy loses. I don't believe that's an appropriate way to deal with this issue. It's my show. Therefore, you're likely to hear my views. I want to hear your views. I want to know what you think. So I look forward to listening to your view when you call 696-929. I'm sorry, it's 646-929-2495. The battle on hunger is one of the more nefarious battles because it tends to be one that most people not directly involved don't see. Those who are in that battle have developed defenses that work more often than not, at least for some amount of time. For instance, a homeless child who's living in a car or who's living in a shelter does not tell his classmates where he lives, generally speaking. The reason for that is because of ostracism, being picked on, being set apart as something he's not. Even as the number of homeless children and hungry children grows, this truth remains. There was a case that we talked about of a person in the state of Texas, city of Longview, who, you know, they set up the school system so that the cafeteria system is built on the same kind of cards that we decry against the poor who are on SNAP, because schools have cards too. And you pay into the card, parents pay into the card to provide meals for the children through the cafeteria. They're cafeteria charge cards, okay? And this particular student went to the lunch line one day, got his meal, went to the cash register, and the cashier found out that he was 30 cents short on his card. And while making the announcement of his being short this amount in view of the entire line, one of the cafeteria workers took the child's plate and threw the food in the trash and said, "You don't pay, you don't eat." Now, the school had sent a notification to the parent. On the day in question, the parent had called the school and said, "I am on my way to bring a payment to recharge the card. Please provide my child with food." With that knowledge in hand, before the child went through the line, instead of letting the child go with the food, knowing it was going to be paid for, or the other alternative, giving the child what was called an alternative meal, which is always free and always available to any child in the school at any meal, what the child got was nothing except humiliation and hunger. When the mother came to recharge the card and found out from the child what had happened, she took the child out of school. I don't blame her. And as far as I know, there's a school board action that's under investigation, and there are employment issues that are under investigation, and there are lawsuits under investigation. The net result is that child has been traumatized for what probably will be the remainder of his school years. He has been set apart, and he will be set apart for who knows how long. Now, this is a child who is not necessarily falling through the cracks in the food chain because he can't afford food. This is an action of prejudice because he didn't pay for a meal, or he couldn't pay the entire charge for a meal. The problem that I see with that more than anything else was the expectation on the part of that cafeteria worker that the actions performed were somehow acceptable. They weren't. And beyond all the apologies and all the tries to make up and all that, you're not going to take that moment away from the child or his classmates. Now, I will guarantee you that while they spent the rest of the day ostracizing that child, when they got home, every one of them made sure that their cards were paid. And they're going to tell their parents of the story of what happened to the boy who kids was a little bit short on his card. And whether or not they tell that child's name, they're going to tell the story. And the story is not going to be complete. The only thing they have is the fear that the same thing would happen to them. And all of a sudden, they experience, perhaps for the first time, what generally is referred to as food insecurity, without ever having felt the hunger that goes along with it. My problem is that it was the expectation of acceptance propelled this worker to perform this trauma on this child, to perpetrate against that child an evil that was, among other things, completely unnecessary. But they somehow had the belief that it was their right to do this to this child because the child was 30 cents short on his food charge. And we talked about that for some time, too. We talked, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago with one of our coffee party hosts, Egberto Willis, who actually lives in Texas, and spoke to the fact that Texas is the number one state in the union for SNAP subsidies, gets the largest percentage, and feeds a lesser percentage of the population than any other state in the union. He gave it an example, California, who receives less percentage of the subsidy for SNAP federally, yet feeds more students. Texas alone is the number one recipient of SNAP benefits in the union, feeds fewer people than other states with less money who feed more children. So while there's a boatload of money available to the state of Texas, it doesn't feed the largest number of students in the school program or in the SNAP program, for that matter. Texas also leads the nation in the number of unemployed women, for instance, or uninsured people, for instance. And it becomes a regional issue or even a state issue when you look at the division of wealth that the government provides for SNAP programs versus the number of people fed or given nutritional assistance by that program. So there's no parity there. How did that happen? One could say it was because of filibuster negotiation by the Texas representatives. They did their job. They got the number that they could get for Texas, which happened to be the largest number of any state receiving SNAP benefits, the ones who decry it the loudest, which is, you know, that's doublespeak no matter how you look at it. So if we then decide that in our redivision of SNAP supplement based upon the new numbers, perhaps Texas shouldn't be the number one state receiving SNAP benefits. After all, Texas tends to tell us that they don't want benefits from the state or from the government. They're not interested in what the government can provide to them. How can that be? They're the largest recipients, but they give the smallest amount per their citizens. That's not fair. The question is, are we looking for fair? There are many who are not, because they have a definitional difference of not only what their responsibility is, but what they believe the role of government is. The only challenge is, how do we make it so that the people who are hungry are not the victims of their ideology? And when we talk about the hunger cliff, we talked about those people who monthly are being added to the long line of people who are subject to being pushed over the hunger cliff, and it's being added to every single month. That is one of the main features of all the battles in the war on the poor. No matter which area we look at, we're going to find that monthly, the number of people who are being impacted negatively in this particular battle, whichever one it may be, is growing. That's a significant reality to understand. It's one we must understand, because that's what's happening. That's the result of all these policies that we seem to be so quick to come up with. That's why we're having this conversation. That's why I want you to hear, and I want you to consider, and I want you to listen. Because if you don't know what to look for, it's most likely you're never going to see it. You don't know that your friend's children are hungry. The question is, if you did know, would you do something about it? Would you say that's their fault? It's up to their parent to take care of it? I don't give a damn? Really? While understanding that the reason you don't know about it is because the parent of that child fully realizes that is exactly your opinion and would never come to you and ask you for help to give you the opportunity to slam them in that way and then refuse them. The child standing in line who's hungry, doesn't have the ability to pay for a food meal, would never go in line, but would rather go to the library or sit quietly at a table in the cafeteria and not eat, say, oh, I'm not hungry today, or some other thing to protect themselves against the ostracism of being too poor to pay for lunch, or to sit there with an alternative meal, everybody knowing it's an alternative meal, and saying, no, you can't do it. No child is going to voluntarily admit to anyone that they're hungry. They'll be hungry for a long time, but they won't admit it to their friends because they're embarrassed. They're ostracized. And it's impossible for a child to live in that situation safely because they can be bullied. There's little doubt that they're worthy of being bullied because, after all, look at who they are. Look at what they do. If it's not possible, then where's the help? Do they go to the school guidance counselor? Do they go to their parent? Where do they go? Where is help for them? And if they go to their guidance counselor, and the guidance counselor, or their school teacher, their classroom teacher, who, by the way, is most often the first point of solution to this problem, because school teachers all over the country, every single day, take money out of their own pockets to pay for school lunches for their kids. It happens every single day. And sometimes it happens every day for the same student. Because if you're looking at a point of care, if you're looking at a point of solution, I will guarantee you this child's teacher is most likely to be the first point of solution in the entire process. And the teacher may go quietly to the guidance counselor and say, this child, or they'll go to the principal and they'll say, this child. And then the discretionary funds that the school administration provides may in fact be sufficient to provide meals on a card. They'll charge the, and usually there won't be a different price. Sometimes there is, because they'll get an administrator discount or something. And a kid may even come to know this. The kid behind him will go, how come mine was $3.10 and yours was only $2.80? You know, and the kid says, well, I paid for a year instead of a month, or whatever lie works. But this is the pressure that you're putting on the kid. And the battle of hunger is 9 times out of 10 focused on the needs of a child at the cost, or in many cases, to the exclusion of the parent, who may be working 2 jobs to provide what they can in terms of eat, sleep, and warm for their children. They may be a single parent. They may be one of 2 parents, each of whom is working 2 jobs. We don't know what the current situation is for every single child that's hungry in America today, or every single adult that is hungry today. We only know that they're being pushed over the hunger cliff with the stripping of these benefits. We do know that. If you look at the possibility of losing an additional $5 billion in January to the SNAP program on top of the $5 billion that was lost on November 1st, and then you look at the subsidies that are being paid to the 3 largest corporations in agribusiness in the United States, you could take that $10 billion that was cut, put it back in the program, and not even touch the reduction to the benefits and the subsidies that these 3 companies are getting. Wouldn't touch them. Example. Is it simply a rare and unique circumstance of serendipity that the same Walmart corporation who receives $2.1 billion every single year in subsidies from the United States government to an average of $904,000 per year per store has invoked the notion that it's okay to require its employees to work on Thanksgiving, traditionally a closed holiday for which the employees are paid holiday pay, in virtually 90% of the retail markets in the world. But Walmart decides it's going to have its stores open on Thanksgiving because freedom. I don't know why. Now, before we go into this in any great length, I want to point out that Walmart is not the only retailer who has decided that its employees are going to work Thanksgiving. There are many others that you would know, like Office Depot, like Lowe's, like, you know, many retailers, Sears, are going to have Thanksgiving Day openings at some point between midnight and midnight. I don't know exactly what the whole list is, but there are many that have been listed at several places. So I want you to understand that when these employees are working on the holiday, they may or may not receive holiday pay. They may receive holiday pay that is not equal to the pay they have lost prior to this because they signed up to work, or they may not receive pay that's going to equal the amount of hours that they will have cut in the following weeks to make up for the money they made on Thanksgiving. Okay? This is a program that talks to the reality of a situation as opposed to the theoretics of the situation as much as we can, and this we know. I'm using Walmart as a particular example of how a company that receives on average $952,000 per year per store from the United States federal government in a subsidy for which it does nothing at all, you understand? It doesn't buy American. It doesn't exclusively sell American. It doesn't hire just American employees. It doesn't do anything that is specific to the good of the common people of the United States of America except compete with other stores in a retail market. That's all it does. Okay? You need to understand that. The reason why this matters so much is because of the war on the poor, on the battle of hunger, on the battle of employment, on the battle of education, on the battle of everything you can think of. There is but one simple example that may appear to be in one position on the front, but when you dig down into it, you find out certain things. We're going to take this as an example and then expand from it. I want you to understand that. It's important that you understand that when you understand something, you should understand it fully. You should understand it from both sides, because Walmart is a nefarious player in so many different areas of this. We have gone to Walmart and asked them to explain to us in several different locations. Several different media sources have done it, online, mainstream, and Walmart will not do it. They will not tell us the reality, but the employees will. So the information that I'm giving you today has been gotten firsthand by me from employees who are affected, okay? And that only confirms what other sources have learned. So it's not going to be any great reveal to that extent. It's something that many of us already know, but we feel the necessity to bring out to the public because we want an open accounting of what's going on. Therefore, that's what we're doing. We're doing it here. I will admit to you it is a bit of a tangled web, but we need to get through that web before we understand why the implications are so important to the employees of Walmart, not to mention the citizens of the United States. And I will say this one more time. Walmart is not the only player that chooses this course for its employees or its business. There are many. It would also be said that there are many who do not choose this course, but rather choose to simply remain closed on Thanksgiving to give its holiday to its employees. And in many of those cases, those employees will receive holiday pay as if they had worked it, because that's what holiday pay, you know, actually is. Whether or not the employer determines that in order to be paid for a holiday, that holiday must be paid, or in the case of many businesses, and I know that it's generalized utility truth in the trucking industry, that in order to be paid for a day off on Thanksgiving, you have to work the 2 days prior and the 2 days following. If you work the 2 days prior and the 2 days following Thanksgiving, you get Thanksgiving off at double time, okay? And the double time is the average of your previous 2 weeks' wages. So they don't count the week of Thanksgiving. They count the previous 2 weeks. Well, as it turns out, so does Walmart. And what they do is when, say, the 1st of November, but more usually around the day before Halloween, Walmart employees are given a list that they can sign up for to work for Thanksgiving. And if they sign up for Thanksgiving, they will be paid holiday pay. Now, holiday pay will be paid to anyone working at Walmart on Thanksgiving. Okay? So they know per schedule who is typically not supposed to work on Thanksgiving. And those are the first people that get the load of the lion's share of hours that are available on Thanksgiving, because they have a staff of employees that normally work every day on Thursday. So if it's Thanksgiving, they need at least that many people to work, because now we're an open day, and they know what force they need to work those hours on Thanksgiving overnight, especially overnight. So 2 weeks prior, they send out a list to their employees and say, if you'd like to work Thanksgiving and receive holiday pay, sign up here. And that sounds good. You know, Thanksgiving comes and goes, and the employees who didn't sign up for it are still working on Thursday, but because the hours they work on Thursday fall on Thanksgiving, they get holiday pay for those hours they work, okay? In the instance of those other employees that signed up for the list, they too get paid holiday pay for the hours they work on Thanksgiving, but their world is a different place, and here's why. In order to continue their pay, what happens is Walmart goes to those employees who have signed up for work for the extra hours that are available for Thanksgiving, for those who are normally not working Thanksgiving or any Thursday or that Thursday, and they start counting backwards. And for 2 weeks prior to Thanksgiving week, they cut those employees' hours by, say, 25%. So if you're working 30 hours a week, well, you'll be working 24 hours for the 2 weeks prior to Thanksgiving. Not only that, but you'll also be working 24 hours a week for the 2 weeks following Thanksgiving. Now, that's an average of 6 hours per week times 4 weeks, which is 24 hours. And you may work 6 to 8 or even 10 hours on Thanksgiving at time and a half, which means you'll get paid for 15 hours, which means you're losing 11 hours of pay for the privilege of working for Walmart for some number of hours on Thanksgiving Day. And that's how Thanksgiving Day holiday pay works at Walmart. That's the reality. If you can tell me by figuring out a normal sequence of events where a person who normally works 30 hours a week is taken away 6 hours for 4 weeks at 24 hours and then works 10 hours is going to make out better than the employee who didn't sign up is going to work Thursday anyway, gets holiday pay. It doesn't make sense. It's an added advantage. Now, Walmart has come out in its own self-defense even before investigation was done and did two things. The first thing it did was it wrote an article that proclaimed that its employees were excited about the nominal idea of Walmart being open on Thanksgiving. It didn't address the feelings that they had about working Thanksgiving. It said that our associates are excited by this notion. Okay. The second thing it did was Walmart instituted a system-wide, which means company-wide, which means around the worldwide, donation drive of canned food or other foodstuffs to be given to, you'd think, the community, right? Well, it's not. The food drive is for Walmart employees who have to work Thanksgiving Day. Walmart then came out and said, yeah, but we're going to do something special this year for those employees who work on Thanksgiving. You're going to be fed. You have to show up 2 hours early before your shift, and of course those hours won't be paid, but you will be able to feed, and we'll feed you. I don't know if that includes your family or not. I don't know. I'm not a Walmart employee. No Walmart employee has spoken to me on this particular fact, but the understanding is that it is the employees who will be fed. And then somebody will receive the donations that have been given by Walmart employees for employees who will not be able to work on Thanksgiving but don't have the ability to feed their families. This is an issue which Walmart readily admits, that there are employees in its employ who will work Thanksgiving who do not have the ability to provide Thanksgiving dinner for their families, and in some cases may not provide a reasonable meal for their families because of the fact that they don't get paid enough, because they don't get enough hours. When you're working minimum wage for 30 hours a week, you don't have leftovers. You don't have the ability. You have to choose between rent and food most often. Unless, of course, you're special and you have to choose between medication and rent. In that case, well, if you've got a sick child and you work 30 hours a week at Walmart, you're on your own because they don't employ, they don't offer things like health benefits to part-time employees, which is why they have only part-time employees. So there's one more little part to this that has to be considered. That store that just did that to its employees is most likely going to receive about $900,000 from the federal government of the United States of America this year. Now, I'm not particularly sure why that is. If it's an employment incentive, it's failed miserably. If it's a production incentive, it's failed miserably because most of the production of goods sold by Walmart did not occur in the United States of America. I know this to be true for several reasons, one of which is I, like you, can go into any Walmart store at any time and look at any product to see where its original manufacturing is. And you will find that Made in America simply does not exist on their product. And by and large, now there may be one or two that do, certainly, but you'll find, like I do, that virtually any product that you purchase at Walmart has an original manufacturer, origin, country of origin, other than the United States of America. One of the most common of these that you can look at is their own brand called Faded Glory, for instance. And you will see that it is not made in America. It's a Walmart brand, but it's not made in America. It's made in some third world country among several. It could be Bangladesh. It could be China. It could be Vietnam. It could be India. It could be some other place. But I guarantee you it certainly could be China, but it will not be the United States of America. Why? I would submit there are at least two reasons. First of all, it is much, much cheaper to run a sweatshop or a child labor service in some other country than it is in America. Now, that's also part of the reason I would presume that billions of dollars comes to Walmart is because of its international retailing merchandising operations, that they can go out and create jobs in these places and get paid nothing for it, but Walmart gets paid $9 billion for the effort. Okay, because it takes money. I mean, it costs money to build a factory in China. Although Walmart doesn't own a factory, China does. If you have any product that is made in China, you need to understand that you don't own that product. You have to buy it back from China in order to sell it overseas. So it could be that the United States government is funding these expansion operations to international markets because they're providing jobs for people in other places, all well and good. However, they're sweatshops. They don't have labor laws. They don't have safety laws. They don't have this sort of stuff. that is required to have a business of employees in the Americas, which makes it more expensive to produce here. That's why they do it, okay? And from that international bounty that they get from the United States government every year, they split some portion of it between all the stores. And while we know what the accumulated total of that part of the bounty is, it's by no means a reflection of the complete payment made by the United States to Walmart. We're not talking about that. We're just talking about the part that we see on a regular basis. Every year, the average store gets $900,000+ as part of the incentive that they get from the government to do this business, because they believe that it impacts all their stores. Therefore, all of their stores should get some bounty for it, even if that store that they're paying to doesn't hire employees to work or doesn't pay employees to make things. It simply pays employees to sell things, to work cash registers, to work the stock and work the third shift and stock the shelves. It pays for its fleet of trucks and drivers, which are paid non-union wage without benefits. It's everything to Walmart's benefit, which is why the six people who are included in the majority of the Walton family right now are the richest people in the world. And if you put their accumulated wealth together, they outstrip several major nations in terms of earned income per year. So there's another part of this, and that is that $900,000+ each store gets is not on its books. It doesn't go into its earned capital, which is why Walmart can prepare a store, build a store, stock a store, and never open a store and close it, which they've done many, many times. And I was in the middle of one of them, and it became a life-changing experience for me. But I want to tell you another story about a man named Sam Walton, who I knew. I will tell you how I knew him. I worked at a time in my life as a second job selling blank videotape in Denver, Colorado. And the company I worked for had worked for a very long time and had a good reputation, and they not only sold blank tape, but they did reproductions, and they would do, you know, they were heavy in the VHS tape business and reproduction and all that. And as it happened, the account came up, and it was the case in our company, the best salesman got the best accounts. But we had to get them. We had to create them. So it came to me to call the marketing manager of Walmart International. At the time, Sam was still alive, and that was Sam. So I talked to Sam in his office at his home and told him that we ran a blank videotape service and we would like to provide the Walmart brand blank VHS videotape for his stores. They had Fujifilm, they had all kinds of other types of manufacturers' blank tapes. They didn't have a house brand, so what we wanted to do was we wanted to create a house brand and provide that tape to the Walton Enterprises so that they could sell them to all their stores. You know, their stores could sell them. And he sounded interested. He thought it was a pretty good deal. He kind of liked the idea and said, come on down to Bentonville. We'll talk about it. Well, I did. I went. I met his dog and his truck and his horse and his wife and had dinner and went to talk about it, did the numbers. And he figured if we started with a stock order of, say, 250,000 blank tapes, he'd spread them out among some of his stores and see how they sold at the price that we commended him that we could provide it with his markup, okay? And he was happy with that. We sold the tape. I was a big guy on campus for a minute, and we sold that 250,000 stock order, and we placed it. We shipped it to his stores, to the addresses he gave us or his people gave us, and he called me, and he said, I got your tape. And I said, great. I said, how's it working? He said, it's fine. It worked wonderful. It's a good product. Proud of it. We want another 250 to put in, you know, a few more stores to see if we can get it to catch on as a brand against Fuji and all the other. I remember Fujifilm because that was his big provider. And he could say made in the United States of America, you know, made in the USA. It could be right on there. He liked that idea. And then came the day that he said, Bud, we got a problem. And I said, what's the problem? I said, you know as well as I do, you never have a problem with us. Any customer can return that tape, used or unused, tell us it's effective, and we'll replace it at no cost, no questions asked. That can't be a problem. What's the problem, Sam? He said, I have discovered that I can get the same tape at a penny less per container load from Korea, and I'm going to go with that provider because it's cheaper for me. And I said, what's this whole Made in America thing? Isn't that worth a penny a container load? And he said, actually, no. No, it's not, because then I have to factor that penny into every thing I sell, and it's too much work. So we're just going to go with them and buy it by the container load. And I said, well, if the production size is the problem, we can provide exactly as much tape as they do on exactly the same schedule for the same price I quoted you. And I'll give you another penny off. He wouldn't take it. And that's how we sold our film for 30 days to the Walmart stores. Now, come to find out, that decision was not even made by him. It was made by another member of his family, and he kept apologizing for it. Evidently, he felt like he had to do this to keep family peace. So you can't argue with a man against his own family. Can't be done. So we kept touch, and every 30 days I'd contact him and say, are you ready to go back to business yet? And he said no. He said no every single time I asked him. So that was the end of the production that my company had with Walmart stores and selling blank videotape, which gave me a clue as to the difference between perception and reality with Walmart. And when Sam died, I was very sad because he was somebody that I'd known and done business with, and he was a good man, you know. And there were other things that happened shortly thereafter that got my goat with Walmart, and as a result of that, I have a kind of a hard feeling against them, okay, because the perception is not equal to the reality. And with Walmart, it's true all the way through the process, okay. They talk about our associates being excited about the possibility of working on Thanksgiving, but they won't tell you that they're going to have a net loss in income for having done it. It just won't happen. So the problem is that most Walmart employees that are scheduled to work on Thursday don't sign up to work Thanksgiving because they don't want to take that cut in pay. They're going to work anyway. They're going to get their pay anyway. They have nothing to lose. Walmart has a problem because then it has to schedule other people to work Thursday, and the way they choose to do that was with a volunteer sign-up list for those who want to work Thursday Thanksgiving. However, it's going to cost them pay over the top because they're going to lose 6 hours. They're going to lose 12 hours before, 12 hours after that, to cover at least the pay they get on that holiday. So it is the employer who's offering, but it is the employee who's paying for that time, and they're going to have a net loss because of it, so that they can open a few hours early on Thanksgiving instead of at midnight on Black Friday or whatever time they choose. I think it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and they're going to avoid getting their customers killed, they think, or having squishes at the door or having security guards that are killed, employees hurt, or any of that other stuff, and they see this as the benefit that makes it worthwhile for them to open hours on Thanksgiving so that they can kind of meter the rush, okay? There's a problem with this that exists in their advertising as well, because they will advertise specials for Black Friday, okay? They'll tell you that their 60-inch TV is on sale for $59, but what they won't tell you is that that's only for one TV per store, and you can't back order special items. So if you're not the first person in line to get that TV, it's not a special. It's no longer on special for you. You have to pay the regular rate, whatever their sales price normally is, or retail price. It's bait and switch. It's typical. It's classic bait and switch. Okay. Now, we do have a 52-inch, but it's $9.99. Our 60-inch is now $1,800. That special that we had for the midnight is over because we don't have any more in the store. And if we don't have any more in the store, we're not going to order them at the special price. They may have 50 in the back waiting, you know, so that it reaches the special price. But if they have 6 in a store, they sell 6, and the 7th one is at the full rate. That's the way it goes at Walmart. That they're not unique in that. There are many stores that do that, okay? They may tell you that they're going to bust out with a new version of World of Warcraft, okay? It's an updated expansion pack, but they're only going to have it during Black Friday. Fine. Everybody lines up to go get the World of Warcraft expansion pack. After 6 are gone, they find out that there's the regular price because the specials have already been sold out. Now, those 400 people that are behind them in the line are not going to have the opportunity to buy that version of that volume of World of Warcraft because it's not going to be in. It's only going to be in at the regular price. Their cash registers will show them sold out. But you can go back to the shelves and find it filled with that special Warcraft expansion pack. The only difference is it's $40. Okay? Now, this is commonplace among special event sales. They have a limited supply, and as long as that supply is available, it's available at that price. The question is, when is it available? Well, most stores will tell you if it's in their inventory stock and it's not on the shelf, it's not available. It's only available when it's on the shelves. Walmart will not restock its shelves with its special product, okay? Now, even in the case where in their flyers they'll say available Friday through Sunday, while supplies last. Well, those supplies are six, and those six are the specials. The 500 other ones they've got in the back are not. Different SKU codes, different everything, okay? So that the cash register can't even see them. If you go to somebody and they ring up on the system and they look in the system for the product, they won't even show the product in the store until after the sale is over. And then, of course, they're available by the SCADs at the increased price. Now, this is why I think it's disingenuous of Walmart to say that it's, A, going to be open on Thanksgiving because our employees and our associates love it so much. Your employees love it so much that the first thing you have to do after making that announcement and getting that schedule is that you have to have a food drive for those very self-same employees. And the reason you do that is because you're cutting their pay further from 30 hours a week to 24 hours a week for 6 weeks. Well, no, for 4 weeks, and then try to make it up 15 hours, say, if you work 10-hour shift on Thanksgiving. So you lose, you lose a net of, 9 hours? When you consider that 9 hours is a day's wage for most employees, you've just cut a day on top of the days that you cut the 2 weeks prior and the 2 weeks following Thanksgiving. They can't make it up, and it's a net loss to the employee. Walmart knows that. They do it on purpose. And when they say, we're open Christmas, you can believe me when I tell you that is exactly the same system they have used because they use it for every single holiday. When a store is open 365, 24/7, it's kind of tough to have a separate niche for that special holiday. So some people choose to have the store closed on the holiday, pay their employees the vacation or the holiday pay, and say, thank you very much for being our employee this year. Okay? Walmart doesn't seem to feel the need to do that. They seem to think that it's okay for them to have a product on sale for 4 minutes, to take hours from their employees, bull the public into a bait-and-switch system, and it makes me wonder about these other companies that are doing exactly the same thing that Walmart is doing with the same expectation that nobody's going to say anything about it. And what I'm here to tell you is, when you get billions of dollars from the United States government on an annual basis, I got something to say about it because I pay taxes. And if you're going to tell me that it's going to pay for your sweatshops overseas, I'll tell you what, I'll take that money back. Thank you very much. I've got a better place I can use it, and I would sure as well see you do what we know you could do, which has recently been determined by, economists much more skilled than I, to figure out that you could pay every single Walmart employee from top to bottom an additional $6 per hour and not touch their profit. That would be a good thing, okay? Now, you could pay them an additional $6 per hour. They work 8 hours. That's six times eight? That's 48, right? Okay. How about paying them a better wage for the regular hours they work now? And if you're paying them a minimum wage, maybe you pay them half as much again and extend them to 40 hours. But then you got to buy insurance for them. You got to provide medical coverage for them. You got to buy retirement benefits for them. They're not going to do that. That's just an expense. And Walmart is not about anything that is just an expense. Everything that happens in Walmart has to be paid for at the counter somehow, okay? That's their business model. I don't necessarily decry their business model, but I want to tell you it's inhumane. And it's not pointed toward their employees. It's not even pointed toward their customers, which is the point of the bait and switch. It is all to the benefit of the corporation, which says, we're not about our employees. Our most important thing is the bottom line for our shareholders. Well, okay, if you're a Walmart shareholder and you understand that this kind of evil is going on in your name, you ought to do something about it. And I bet you better do something about it. Now, I'm told that there's a number of places around the company sites that are planning workers' strikes on Black Friday. I think that's at least understandable. When you've got this happening to employees and they take this opportunity to stand up and step out and say, wait a minute, you told us we didn't need a union because you would have, well, if you were unionized, I'll guarantee you none of this would happen. I guarantee it. Because no union in their right mind would allow such a thing to happen to its members. None. It wouldn't happen. We're so quick to forget what it is that unions give us and what they have given us from the time of their first existence when it comes to employee safety employee equity, equal rights for employees, holiday pay, special pay, benefits of health, life insurance, retirement benefits, pensions, that sort of thing. They all come from unions. And if you were unionized, Walmart, if your employees were unionized, you know as well as I do, these things would never happen and it would cost you a lot of money. As far as I'm concerned, if you were unionized tomorrow and they took every single benefit they could take from you, you still wouldn't be even with the employees and the people of your community that you have screwed purposely, maliciously, and with malice aforethought for the purpose of your own bottom line and your own greed interests. And if you want to put it on your shareholders, then your shareholders need to respond to you and say, we either agree with this policy or we don't. They need to be asked the question, which you will not ask them. So we're going to ask them for you. If you're a shareholder of Walmart Incorporated, do you believe that these principles, these business practices are favorable and encouraged by you to Walmart? Is this the way you want to be seen in terms of your civic participation and your community citizenship by allowing people in your name to make sure that their employees are mishandled in these ways? If that bothers you, then you need to tell Walmart. Don't tell me, because I can't do anything about it. But you have to tell Walmart, because they're affecting your entire community. Instead of having reasonable, respectable, meaningful jobs, 8 out of every 10 employees at Walmart have to file for food stamps. Why is that? Why is it that working a full-time job, according to Walmart, which is 30 hours a week, because they won't pay anybody more than that unless you're extremely upper-level management, okay, they won't let you do it. It's not there to be done. They will restrict your hours, and of course there's the hours themselves when you sometimes get to negotiate your hours and sometimes you don't. If you want to work for us in this store, you will work these hours on these days because those are the hours we need covered. It's perfectly, you know, within the realm of the business to dictate which hours its customers and its employees will be available. But if the employee chooses not to take those hours, the only recourse is, well, sorry, work somewhere else. Go ahead, find a job. If you think you can find a job in this town, go ahead. We'll wait. You'll be back. Because the reality is, in retail sales, of course, and in other small businesses, which employ between, you know, 1 in 100 people, say, there are no jobs available. The reason there are no jobs available is because other companies prior to Walmart have moved their businesses offshore as well. And if you don't think that Walmart is offshoring its business, you don't understand what Walmart is doing. They're the largest offshore sourcing for other business in the world, okay? It doesn't matter the brand, doesn't matter the location. They'll go anywhere where they can find cheap, non-labor, non-supported wages. And if you have to live in a dormitory with 75 other people in beds that are made for 30, and you have to work 17 hours a day, 7 days a week for 25 cents a day, that's fine because they're going to sell the product you make at their rate no matter what, because the government is providing the resource for them to pay you. It doesn't come out of their pockets. It comes out of the taxpayers' pockets. And you need to understand that, because when things like this holiday pay scam are worked upon the people of the citizens of your community, they often depend upon you to speak out in their behalf. Because, you know, if people speak out against Walmart and they work for Walmart, they're fired. So we don't want people at Walmart employees to be fired, so we're speaking out on their behalf, and I'm telling you that that is the way holiday pay is figured at Walmart, and I know it because I have talked to over 30 Walmart employees in 3 different cities in the last 10 days. I've made it my business to find out because I thought it was such a scandal to hear of it, I couldn't believe it was true. Well, it is true, and I know it's true in at least this state, and I know because I've talked to local and state employees for Walmart that tell me it's true. So, you know, the Google is your friend and the phone is your ally. So there you go. There are many other stores that are also open this Thanksgiving. It would seem that that could be a good thing for those people who are really hurting for money because they can work extra hours. The question is working those extra hours worth it? Will they, in fact, net lose hours because they worked a holiday, even at time and a half pay? Well, I know of one instance where that's true. And I know where a lot of employees are simply refusing to work at all on Thursday. Now, if they're scheduled to work on Thursday and they don't, they better have a good reason for it. I mean, like a death warrant or something. So That's because every employee, every associate has a certain dollar value per hour to Walmart that brings their business in line, okay? And if they have an employee that's off on Thursday that's scheduled to work on Thursday and they can't find anybody to replace that employee on Thursday, they're in trouble because there's a net loss to them of that block of time. So they come up with an offer. You know, of course, the first person to fill is from the voluntarily, yes, I will work Thursday list, and that will replace that employee that refuses to work on Thursday. I would suspect there's going to be a lot more people not working on Thursday than usual. And I would suspect that there's going to be a lot of people who could have worked Thursday for extra holiday pay that are not working it because they understand that, you know, if they sign up on a list on the 1st of October, they're going to have at least 25% of their hours for the 2 weeks previous to the week of Thanksgiving cut, and they'll lose hours in the following 2 weeks as well. So that's what Walmart calls us, normalizing the schedule, stabilizing the schedule. That's what they're talking about. What they're saying is, we ain't going to pay for it. There ain't no way in hell we're going to pay for it. If it's going to be paid for, it's going to be paid for by somebody else. And if that affects their SNAP benefits, we don't care. The only difference is that when you work a decreased number of weeks for a consistent period of time, and I don't know if it's 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 6 weeks, but I do know that if you work a consistently decreased number of hours over a set period of time, your SNAP benefits increase. And if you don't work but 30 hours on 1 week and then 24 on the next week, you report that to your Department of Human Services, and sometimes they'll support you with additional SNAP benefits for that week. Okay? Sometimes they won't. Depends on the state. Now, of course, my argument with this is, until you treat your employees right and you treat your customers right, you're not entitled to a single penny in government subsidy. So let's take those billions of dollars that we're paying to Walmart and put them into SNAP benefits, because obviously Walmart is a huge producer of the need for SNAP. Okay? So let's put $9 billion, $10 billion of that bonus subsidy into SNAP and not cut the benefits. Let's increase or expand the benefits by $10 billion so people can, first of all, get back the meals they lost, and secondly, maybe make a little bit more each month that is just enough to get them over the edge so that they can actually provide meaningful nutrition to their families with the assistance of the SNAP program to provide those things that you can buy with SNAP, like staples, flour, sugar, you know, milk, those sorts of things, and then spend the extra money on, say, a meat a month, and provide stew meat so that you can have a meal go 3 days instead of one, or you can feed six people instead of four. Because you need to understand that in this war on the poor, the battle of hunger is one of attrition. It's not about nutrition. It's about attrition. And the trouble with SNAP benefits is that there's no automatic cutoff. If you are on SNAP benefits because you qualify for them, as long as you qualify for SNAP benefits, you're going to receive them. Well, there's this thing that says we help those who are least among us. And the question comes, is it that they're on these benefits because they're lazy? Or is it because of some other reason, like they can't find work, they can't get enough hours, they don't have enough money to pay for food and rent, and all of a sudden you've got parents who are choosing to live in cars to save the money from a mortgage or a rental so that they can provide food or other necessities like medicine for their families or for themselves. And in the meantime, you've got the humiliation that people feel for even having to present an EBT card at a grocery store, because everybody knows when you have an EBT card, you're on welfare, you're on food stamps, you're on SNAP. Okay, we know you're not in the WIC program because that's been killed. Women, infants, and children no longer receive the benefits of that program because that program no longer exists, because that was done by the Republicans in an attempt to balance the deficit. I don't know what they were talking about. The deficit's nowhere near what they think it is, and it's gone down consecutively for the last 44 months, while, by the way, employment has gone up consecutively for the last 44 months. So when the deficit goes down, employment goes up, we have what's called a more stable economy. But this economy is not stable because there are those who are trying to submarine it. They need it to be bad. They need it to be bad so that they can justify to their potential electorate the reason to vote for them. Okay? This socialist Muslim Kenyan BS that's going around is just another example of that. We need our base to be upset. We need our base to be afraid. We need our base to be telling our message. because if it's not true, it's not our fault. If our base tells our message and it's a lie that we give them and they don't do the research necessary to find out what the truth is, it's not our fault. It's their fault because they're stupid. Well, don't be stupid. When you look at Walmart and you find out that they're offering their employees additional time at Thanksgiving, that all sounds wonderful, but don't be stupid. Look at it. Talk to some employees and find out, if you're interested in reporting on this, what the truth is. Find out, as I did, what the truth actually is as regards Walmart. If you'd like another store to check out, go ahead, feel free. You know questions to ask them that you may not have known before this broadcast. How does working Thanksgiving affect your previous and post-work hours? In other words, does your hourly amount change, you know, classically over the years? Have you seen fewer hours in the weeks leading up to Thanksgiving or the weeks following Thanksgiving? And then, you know, a couple of weeks, it comes your normal status that you work for the next 50 years or the next 50 weeks until the 2 weeks before Thanksgiving come again? Is there a cycle that you can see in your payroll? Have you looked? Are you willing to? Will you let me help you? Because the only thing I want to know is the truth. And if it's not the truth, I don't want to report it. I don't want to say it. I don't want to think it. But I know this is the truth. And I want you to understand that if you're Big Lots or if you're Office Depot or Office Max or Lowe's or Home Depot or Hobby Lobby or anybody, you know, two guys in a flower shop, I don't care. I want to know if you're choosing to be open on Thanksgiving that you're not requiring your employees to take the hit for it. And I want to know that you're doing business in an upright and forthright manner in my community, because I'm the guardian of my community standards and you're busting them. And in this case, I have a store in my community that's busting them, and I'm going to make sure to let their shareholders know that their name is being used as a defense for these practices. Because according to Walmart, their only interest is increase to the bottom line for the shareholders. So I'm talking to the shareholders of Walmart. Understand this is being done in your name, because evidently you have put such pressure on the board at Walmart that not only do they have to join an entirely illicit organization under the name of the American Legislative Exchange Council to help make model legislation which makes you the largest purveyor of long guns and ammunition in the world through the Stand Your Ground law, which has gotten people killed in your name, shareholders, but it's also subverting other forms of democracy as well. And it's doing that in your name as well. So we want you to know, shareholders, that America is aware of your duplicitous nature and the damage you're causing to America through your agent, which is Walmart. It is Walmart who sponsored the bill that became known as Stand Your Ground and submitted it via their legislative representative choices in 37 ultra-conservative held legislatures to become the Stand Your Ground law, so that Walmart, you know, that board that you're a member of, could become the world's largest leading retailer in long guns and ammunition in the world, as well as a number in the double digits now of directly Stand Your Ground related deaths. That's also being done in your name, because it is that same Walmart that joined together with a couple of other corporations, solicited their own legislators in the Legislative Exchange Council, the American Legislative Exchange Council, we call ALEC, and submitted model legislation to make that available in every state in the union, and they did it in your name. If you're proud of that, I want to hear from you. I want you to call me. I want you to write me. I want you to make a comment. Send me an email at thetennesseeprogressive@gmail.com and tell me why you're so proud of this fact that the store that is working in your name has done these things. I want to hear this, and I think the American people need to hear it too, because obviously we have a difference of opinion. And I want to present as many differences of opinion as possible, because that's what I think leads to success. I think that's how we become the change we seek. And I can tell you that if you're a damn Walmart shareholder and you agree with these principles, I really want to hear from you, because your company ain't saying squat. Now, they can't deny it. They just won't admit it. We show the facts before them through PRWatch.org, through ALEC Exposed, and they don't say the first word, not in denial, not in support, nothing. So we're ignoring the company. We're going to the shareholders that they seem to be so imbued with that they would cause this kind of travesty over so you could have a nickel more per quarter on the bottom line. I want to hear from you. I really, really do. okay? If you'll contact me during this week, I'll put you on my air next week, and I will give you the time to explain your story. I promise you I will. In fact, I'm hoping that you will, because I don't see it. If you want to tell me that the purpose of business is to increase profit on the bottom line to the shareholders and you tell me nothing else, don't waste your time. Okay? I am intelligent. I own 5 businesses. I run them. I have people that I employ. I run these businesses. Okay? I have shareholders. I'm familiar with the concept. I'm familiar with how it works. Of course, I am also a shareholder in other corporations, so I know how that works as well. So if you're going to tell me that you agree with the ploy of Walmart because it increases profit to the bottom line for you, the shareholder, on a quarterly dividend, I want to talk to you, but you better tell me something else. Because if that's all you're telling me, you know nothing about the company that you're holding shares in. But what you need to understand is that when you are holding shares in that company, every single thing that company does reflects on you. Now, it may not reflect negatively in a profit sense, but it certainly will negatively reflect on you in a business sense. And you need to understand that. And you also need to understand that America has citizens who believe that what Walmart is doing is categorically wrong. And not by a large shot is that limited to their employees. Okay? They live in communities. This is a community issue. Many communities would not voluntarily choose to subject its citizens to this kind of employment. In fact, Walmart has seen that before and has shut down stores because of it rather than to pay their employees a minimum wage or to work a 40-hour week. They refuse to do it because it's nonprofit. It's not profitable to them to do it. It has nothing to do with the amount of profit that they make that outshadows every other corporation on the planet, including most governments. It's just the fact that it's a penny more. Now, I heard that from the man himself. I know what a penny more is worth. If it's a container load of videotape and it's worth a penny less to me and a penny less to him, he's going to buy that container load because it's a penny less. So I understand where that comes from. I've dealt with it personally. But I'm telling you, I disagreed with it then. I disagree with it now for exactly the same reason. Made a bunch of money off sold in the USA, made in the USA, sold in the USA. USA, USA, USA. And then all of a sudden we see Korea and China and Japan and Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and Indonesia and Malaysia and India and Bangladesh and all these places. And all I can say is looking up the labor laws for these cities and these countries as I have, I found out what the average wage for the average worker is. I found out what the average benefit for average workers is. And I'm underwhelmed. I'm terrifically underwhelmed. I don't believe that anybody should have to work that way. Now, that's just me. That's only my view. Although, I would tell you that if you're a shareholder in Walmart, you might want to be aware of the fact that it's a view held by many, many millions of Americans who believe that a man should be paid a respectable wage for a respectable day's work. And if you tell me that you can pay these people less because it's unskilled labor, you better bring something other than that as well. And because I'm going to show you statistics on unpaid labor where you're at the bottom, not the top. In fact, the only economic category, labor, statistical, or otherwise, where Walmart leads anybody is in annual profit realized to the shareholders. That's it. They're not going to tell you how much it costs you for them to have profit. I am. Thanksgiving is but one example, but it's one that will work. And I understand that there are a large number of people in a large number of communities that plan to let their resources know how they feel about it come Thanksgiving. I hope they do. I hope that anybody listening to my voice will voluntarily choose not to go to Walmart or any other store on Thanksgiving Day or night. I hope that you will not go to Walmart on Black Friday. I hope that you will not go to Walmart until Walmart announces a change in its basic relationship policy with its employees. But we need to make it so that Walmart feels the pinch on Black Friday in a way that will cause them to listen to the public, if not their shareholders. I want their shareholders to be the ones to tell them, I'm real displeased with what I hear we're doing and you're doing it in my name, stop it, or I will pull my shares. Now, if you pull your shares, you sell your interest in Walmart, probably at a handsome profit, which is probably going to be pretty good, but I'll bet that it won't be long before Walmart has a big, tough time getting people, I know they already are, by the way, to sign up for being shareholders to their company because they just can't. They've run out of people to bulldoze. They've run out of people to buffalo with their false sales pitches. They've run out of reasons to lie. Now they're doing it out in the open, daring people to say something about it. This somebody's saying something about it, okay? And my views are my own. They're not the views of PPTS Radio, and they're not the views of Coffee Party Radio or the America Media Society or America Standard Media, Westwood Media, or NetRoots Radio Network. They're mine, Tennessee Progressive. And I'm telling you, I want you shut down. And I've already told you why, but let me tell you again, just in case somehow you figured out a way to miss it. The way you treat your employees is abominable. The way you treat your shareholders is horrific. The way you treat the communities you serve is, I'm certain, illegal. And the way you deal with your community citizenship is an abomination to the very term. So while I know that Walmart stands to be the largest employer in many communities, I'm not willing to admit that Walmart therefore has the right to bulldoze its employees into substandard living, substandard wages, substandard benefits, substandard safety in order to make profit for the shareholders. Because people are dying, that, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with the shareholders as far as most shareholders are aware, but the shareholders must be aware that one of the primary reasons people are dying is because of the practices of the corporation whose shares you hold. And that cannot be denied. That's why Walmart has made settlement in so many of the cases where people have been injured or killed on their Black Friday launch. Okay? And it is exactly for the reasons that I have told you, not for any other. It is because of the way that day is proceeded to be sold by Walmart concerning the communities it serves. Now, the question I want to ask you is, what are you going to do about it? That is the show's only and often every week commitment to itself and challenge to you. What are you going to do about it? What you need to understand is this is involving the war on the poor. It is also involving several battles of that war, not among the least of which is the battle of hunger, because, as I said, I know for a fact that 7 out of 10, and I think 8 out of 10, now are direct recipients of SNAP benefit assistance, okay, and other assistances as well. And that's because they are not paid a living, respectable wage. And when you work 30 hours a week and you can't pay your rent, they would tell you you need to live in cheaper accommodations. Or, you know, we need to help you and we'll have a fund drive so that you can get your rent paid. The same way, if you work Halloween or Thanksgiving, what we do is we have a fund drive for our employees to give them food so that they can feed their families on Thanksgiving. And the question comes, why in the name of God, if somebody's working Thanksgiving, can't they feed their families on Thanksgiving? Or do you think we're so obtuse that we can't see that? And why are you sitting here telling us that's a good thing? It's a terrible thing. It's absolutely abominable. Not because it's done. Of course, we realize it's done for nothing more than public relations, okay? If there weren't such a hue and cry over this reality that we now know, you would never have done this. You would have continued as you have for the past 40 years, doing exactly the same thing, exactly the same way, to exactly the same people, with exactly the same result. That's what we hate. It's abominable because it must be. It's not abominable because it happens, and there are people who are going to be grateful for every single can of food they get, all right? The reason they're grateful is because they can't afford to buy it themselves. And that is a problem that you, Walmart, should and must suffer for. While you're receiving billions in dollars of federal benefits for which you don't even qualify, there's no qualification given or required. You just get the money. For what? I want to know. And if that money is going to fund a sweatshop in Vietnam, I want that money back in the treasury because we don't support it and you don't deserve it. If it's going to feed the poor, we can talk about it. The sadness is the poor you're talking about is the wages you pay your employees. Walmart could pay every single employee in its employ right now, today, an additional $6 per hour and not touch its profit. Not touch its profit. It would take a lot more than $6 per hour per employee for, you know, the profits of Walmart to be touched. That's a simple reality. Now, When it comes to $9.2 billion in money, I want to tell you something. That's a chunk of change that I want to know about. As a citizen, as a taxpayer, as a progressive Democrat, I want to know where that money's going because it's coming out of my pocket. And I've got this funny thing about, you know, feeling the need to at least have some bit of a handle on what it is that my government is spending money on. And what I see coming from Walmart is a big, fat zero. I don't consider funding the building of a Chinese manufacturing base that you're going to pay employees 25 cents an hour for to be worthy of my dollar. I don't. Not only that, but it's money going down the hole because that building you build, you can't own. If it's in China, you can't own it. It's an impossibility. It belongs and immediately transfers ownership to the Chinese government. That's why you get such a good deal on the land that you buy for that company's building to sit on. Furthermore, every dollar that you make as a result of that company, either in retail sales in this country or other countries, that belongs to China. Only the net belongs to you, and you bring it to the United States, but you don't pay taxes on it. You shelter the taxes that are owed the United States in an offshore fund in the Cayman Islands and in Zug, Switzerland. And if you think that we are so stupid that we don't have people that can find that out, then you're really in a problem because you believe everyone is as stupid as you are, and we're not. Now, you're not going to pay those taxes that are earned on that money. You're going to hide it because, you know, it's profit to the shareholder. No, it's not. Okay, you have to take it out of your account, and you have to hold it in a separate account somewhere surreptitious, somewhere secret, where you think that we, the eyes of the public, much less your shareholders, much less the President of the United States or the Treasury Department or the Department of Justice, are so stupid they'll never look for it there. And I can tell you, as a shareholder, as a customer, you're wrong. And anybody who wants to know about the ongoing current business situation in any corporation in America has to do but one thing, and that is to buy one share of stock in that corporation. One share of stock, and you are a stockholder. As such, you are entitled to all the information that any stockholder in that company, regardless of type or class of stock, is permitted to see. It's a lot more than you'll see in their advertising, I promise you. You'll get annual reports, and you'll see how much was made in this sweatshop in China and how much profit came to the company, which is net after Chinese are paid, and you'll find out that on that, some percentage of money was paid in taxes, but it's never been received by the United States Treasury. It's easy enough to see. It's so easy I can do it, okay? I encourage you to do it as well. In the case of Walmart, I'd suggest anybody go out and buy one share of Walmart. You know, become a shareholder because then you're at equal footing with all those other people who are sending all this money to spend all this money on nefarious purposes like Alec, who believe that they can control the government of the United States through an entity that they don't even know anything about. That would never allow that from them if the monkey beat a tune to hell and back. You would never have that kind of access. It's not your power because there's only a very few people inside the Walmart chain that have that power, and they are very deliberate about who they share that power with. And I'll guarantee you, John Q. shareholder ain't it. They've got congressmen to buy off. They've got senators to buy off. They've got federal governments to buy off. They've got foreign nations to buy off. It gets expensive, you know. It gets expensive. That $9-plus million they get from the federal government, they feel is nothing more than a fair tribute. And that's exactly what it is because they don't do nothing else for it. They don't pay their employees a meaningful wage because of it. They don't provide better quality products for Americans because of it. I've known that since I worked with Sam Walden. That's not a problem, you know. I understand that his business is always about a penny. Wasn't a surprise to me. I always knew it to start with. I knew that that's how the man worked, you know. I didn't know that he had gone so international so quick, and I was a little bit taken aback. My misfortune was not finding him 3 years earlier because we would have had 3 years of a good, you know, product run with our videotape for Walton and Walmart stores and Sam's Club, but it didn't work out that way. And I lament the fact because I held Mr. Sam in the highest esteem, and I'm very sad that his progeny have decided to desecrate his name in such ways as this and others. I'll shut up about it when you let trucks park in your parking lot again, assholes. That was in Mr. Sam's will, after all. Let's see. The Walmarts are doing this. There are other stores that are open on Thanksgiving, and my question to you is to find out who's paying for it. What we found out in our just a little inquiry to Walmart was that Walmart employees were paying for it. And I will tell you that also includes their management. But to Walmart, you're just a different level employee, and all employees are the same as far as Walmart is concerned. They will talk a good game all day long until it comes time to pay that employee. And then all of a sudden, after all the yay, yay, yippee, yippee meetings, you know, the boost-up meetings, the rah-rah meetings and all that, you come to see a pay that somehow is missing 5 or 6 hours of pay. And you wonder where it went, and they say, well, we had to schedule you down these days because we didn't have the need. But now, you know, for Thanksgiving week, on Thanksgiving, we'll have the need that you'll fill, but then we won't have the need for 2 weeks after that because, you know, it takes 2 weeks after Thanksgiving till people really believe it's going to be Christmas. So then we'll talk about putting you back up to, you know, your normal hours until the first of the year. But after first of the year, it's all over with, and what's your normal will be your normal then for another 50 weeks. That's what Walmart says. It doesn't say anything different to those workers that are students that have to pay school or mothers that have to feed children or fathers that have to provide for their families. One of the things that we found out is that a very large percentage of Walmart employees are taking SNAP benefits. What we also found out is among the SNAP benefits, a very large percentage of SNAP benefits are going to those who have at least one part-time job. That's the beginning of a dissonance. Wait a minute. If people are working and they still have SNAP benefits, why is that? And the answer is because Walmart. It's not that they're not working a sufficient number of hours. It's that the hours they're working are not providing them with a sufficient amount of income to provide the basic needs of their family. In our country, we used to consider that to be kind of a benchmark of what reasonable employment was. We used to consider that a benchmark of what good corporate citizenship was. And we found that if the corporate citizen was not being a good corporate citizen, we would simply revoke their charter. I submit that that's what should happen to Walmart. I really do. And I know that Walmart has destroyed a lot of towns, has destroyed a lot of business. And you can't hear anything about Walmart by talking to anybody concerned about Walmart that will not spend hours telling you about Miss Susie's flower shop down on the street or Miss the dress shop or the milliner or, you know, the auto parts store or something that became redundant in a literal sense when Walmart showed up. And in interesting cases, some of those are about properties that were purchased by Walmart that were even under offer to other corporations, other businesses who wanted to expand or grow or come into a town with their business. Those are the places that Walmart chose because they were prime locations or sometimes because it was somebody else offering to buy them. And it became a part of their marketing war. They weren't worried about downtown because they didn't deal with downtown. They were not downtown. You'll very seldom find a Walmart in a downtown area. The closest you'll get is a close downtown mall occasionally if, you know, that's the first Walmart in the community. So many of the times that are there, they'll start in the mall. Of course, that means that, you know, the mall's going to see a good time from one of its new anchor stores, and it's going to have to raise the triple net on all the other lessees because, after all, I mean, if this one's doing it, it's rising the price for everybody. So, you know, the little guy in the hallway's got to make it too. And that little guy in the hallway is much more likely to clear out and go somewhere else. It's now time for him to have his own business address, which Walmart will eventually kill, but that's okay. I'm talking about the economics of killing a town for the purpose of, you know, private retail enterprise. And it is not untoward for Walmart to close a store. In fact, I've seen Walmart close the stores before they open, simply for the purpose of creating a negative impact on some member of that community. Because Walmart can be rather malicious when it wants to, and has a record of it. So I'm not talking tales out of school. It's common knowledge. Now, these other stores that are also working to be open on Thanksgiving, we believe, as a matter of principle on this show, that you have the right to do that. We do not believe, however, that you have a right to mislead your employees or the public in the doing of it. And you need to understand that that's where I'm coming from. I believe that if you do it fairly, if you give a reasonable, you know, a reward for your employees that are not going to net cost them for having done it, then you have the opportunity to take that chance. But I'm still going to recommend strongly that nobody go shopping on Thanksgiving evening. I'm going to recommend that you spend that time alone at home with your families in a shelter, visit a nursing home, watch a football game, go to a bar, go to some small business in your community, you know, and look around and do some window shopping, but don't spend a penny. Just prove the point. Don't spend a penny on Thanksgiving for shopping. And when you go to Black Friday, don't go to Big Box. Don't go to stores that you know are open on Thanksgiving, do not go to Walmart, because you're only enabling their bad practices. And I think we should send them a message, the same way I think we should send a message to their shareholders. And if it be by protesting on Black Friday, so be it. I encourage that at every Walmart store in America. I think that it's time for the employees to speak up, to understand that they don't have to be afraid for their employment, although it is possible that if you're an employee and you protest Walmart on Black Friday, you'll lose your job. I believe that there's not a person who signed up to protest on Black Friday at Walmart that doesn't know that, and they're willing to do it anyway because they figure they've already lost enough to make it worthwhile. They can't take much more from them. Now, I've done some pretty hard picking on Walmart, and their day is coming. They're going to feature in at least four of our battles that we're talking about in this battlefield on the war on the poor. But this one has to deal with hunger. And when you realize that a very large majority of Walmart employees are also benefit recipients of the SNAP program, that when you're cutting SNAP benefits, some of the people you're cutting those benefits for are also working as much as they legally can because of the benefits they receive. And it's the benefits they receive that are of such import to them that they won't take additional hours of employment because they don't want to lose those benefits, because those benefits mean more than extra hours of employment do. And we are enabling that to happen with the Walmarts of the world when we understand that Walmart is not paying its employees a reasonable wage, that it is purposely keeping them on a glass ceiling that provides no benefits for them whatsoever, whether they be health care benefits, life insurance benefits, retirement benefits, any benefits at all, tuition assistance benefits, nothing. Okay? This is Walmart we're talking about, and that's not what they're about. They need people to fuel their cash. Their cash goes into their cashier's boxes and their cash registers. Everything else is extraneous, supplemental, back office expense for them. That includes their employees. Now, there are people who are satisfied working at Walmart, who like Walmart, and I say, God bless you, good luck to you, but I hope you lose your job. I hope you lose your employer. Because there are many more of your fellow employees who are suffering because they work at Walmart than those who are benefited. It's hard to say that getting 30 hours a week is not a benefit when that's the only job in town. I understand that. And you're willing to take the price, as many workers of a company-owned town are, but there's an option that you have, and that is to let your voice be heard. On Black Friday, you certainly have an opportunity to have your voice heard, and I hope that everyone who hears this between now and Black Friday will let their voice be heard. You're speaking out against hunger. You're speaking out against the forced hunger that Walmart and companies like it, not definition in size or gross revenue or location, big box or otherwise, any company that allows its employees to live under such decrepit conditions that are manifested upon them by their employer are companies that should not be in business, because it's bad business. It's bad community citizenship. It is bad. It's bad faith, okay? And you need to know, if you're going to honor a company with your service, you need to understand you have the right to ask what their processes are, what their policies toward their employees are. And any business owner or manager that would say to you that's none of your business, you would be well advised to tell them that as a member of the citizenry of the community, it's absolutely your business. And don't leave until you get an answer. Even if the answer is a policeman escorting you out the building, that's an answer. That's something you can talk about. That's something you'll want to share with your friends and your neighbors in this show. Tell us what's going on. We want you to be prepared. We want you to know in advance that if you go to XYZ Corp and ask them what their affiliation with their community is by the way they treat their employees, and they tell you it's none of your business, tell them they're false. Tell them they're under some kind of misguided misunderstanding. It's absolutely your business because you pay taxes. And a lot of the taxes you pay are in their cash register. So you really want to know. And we want to find people that we should be able to praise and find worthy. That's what we're actually after. We want better examples than Walmart to talk to people when we talk about the war on hunger, when we talk about the war on the poor, or the battle of hunger, or the battle of education, or the battle of justice, social, criminal, and otherwise. We want to talk about the good examples. I'd much rather spend time saying, listen, I heard about this company you guys need to hear about because this is how they treat their employees and this is how they treat their communities. I don't want to hear any more about companies that threaten their employees with immediate employment if they don't get off the strike line and come back into work for the 32 days until the company moves to China, like we heard on this show last year. And the company did move to China, and it did close on December 22nd, just like it said it would, by the way. Merry Christmas. And what's going on now, those employees have had to find work other places and created for themselves what was a hometown is now a ghost town. And we reported on that as it happened, and it became a battle over substance and resource. If they lost their jobs, what were they going to do? And most of them had no answer because they were already on SNAP and other benefits because they were employed. Now, when they became unemployed, they lost a series of those benefits. And what they've done is they've left town because, you know, the only other job available in that town was the competition with the company they served. Because they were employees with that company, they're not available for hire by the only company left standing. So they've had to leave town in order to find work and life because there was no work for them in that town. And rather than drive the distance to another town back and forth to pay community property taxes on a community that didn't support them, then they're not much willing to deal with it, okay? There was a lot of work and a lot of effort by the mayor of that town, by some of the civic leaders in that town, to negotiate to keep the company there. But the company came in with the notion of taking those jobs out of that community on purpose because it needed the technology and the specialists for that technology in a different country. And they did offer employment to people if they would move to a different country. And as far as I know, 100% of the people of that town said, no way, we will not do that. And we wanted to commit our lives to this place. This is our community, and we're not leaving it to work for you in another country at, you know, substantially lower rates without benefits or protections. So we'll take our chances here, and we'll be poor here before we'll be rich somewhere else because we believe that that's a bad thing to do. So far as I'm aware, 100% of the employees of that company that were in this town in Illinois said that. And that town that they lived in is virtually a ghost town now. I think there's less than 900 people in that town now. And when you talk about resources that are available to people who are having a tough time of it, you need to understand that every time a resource is cut, it affects more than one person, okay? The SNAP benefits, you can see very easily a return of investment for $1 spent, you'll get about $1.80 back, $1.90. That's the national average. There are those that are higher than that and those that are lower than that. And when you cut those benefits, you take $5 billion out of the economy, that precludes $10 billion in the economy because of that $5 billion in the economy. That grows the economy. It's about growing the economy, and if you grow an economy with $5 billion to a total of $10 billion, you've grown the economy. And Joe Small Business is going to count on the dollars because they are immediately spent. People don't save up their EFT card money. They don't. They just don't. They will either sell them, or they will find a way to extend them, or they will spend them. And they will spend them in places and in ways that are not legal because, let's face it, it's kind of hard to argue why the SNAP benefit program refuses to allow you to buy toilet paper, but they do. Same with paper towels. Same with any other non-consumable item, including cigarettes. Interestingly enough, you can buy alcohol with it because it's a consumable good, but that's another story altogether. And there are places that will tell you we don't sell alcohol to anyone paying with food stamps because it's a nefarious practice that we don't agree with or some other such. You can't buy medical care with food stamps. It's not a general economy item. It's a specific item to a food economy. And if you lessen the food economy, you hurt everyone, everyone, because those people who are, say, working Janes and Joes that do have enough money to provide their own nutrition all of a sudden find their grocery costs rising by 25%. And they say it's because of those dad-burned food stamps. Well, of course it is. We put $10 billion in a $5 billion economy. Yeah, it's because of food stamps. Makes all the sense in the world to me, okay? But they don't know any better. So they're using a false argument for a false end to justify their own stupidity. And that's not America. That's not who we are. And I believe that that's what I'd like to talk about for a little bit, because we just finished the experience of a week of reflection on the 50-year anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And there's been a lot of talk around the blogosphere and around other places about what that means. And there's been some arguments hitherto and since about, you know, that one of the more interesting realities that I've experienced on this 50th anniversary is the reignition of arguments that people have as reasons to hate the president. And it's interesting that after 50 years, there are those people around who were there then that had such a vicious hatred of the president that they can't let the death of the president stop the argument because they've got to blame him for something. I read an article yesterday that said, well, he wasn't a very good president and he wasn't very effective and he cost us a lot. And here's the reasons why. First of all, it was a false list. It was a list that was not true. And the second, it was a list that was not accurate. And thirdly, what it was a list of the deceptions that caused so many people to hate the president in the first place, come back to life after 50 years. And that I found remarkable. I found it remarkably offensive and told the article writer so in his article at the Washington Post yesterday, or on the 22nd, actually, which was the anniversary of the assassination. And the TV's been rife with them. You need to understand that this is something that has been celebrated around the world. And single-handedly, there has been 10 out of 10 remarks from outside this country in honor of the president. It seems to be only within this country that there's been a real problem. I mean, you know, Vietnam sent condolences to the United States over the loss of our president. But we had people in the Washington Post that felt necessary to write derogatory articles about the president on the 50th anniversary of his assassination. If that's not small-minded bullshit, I don't know what is, okay? But that is what it is. And that's what I called it. And I called it that because that's what I think it is. And in a place where my opinion is my opinion and I can say my opinion, whatever I think my opinion is, that's my opinion. It's bull. It's stupid. It's disrespectful. It's mistimed. It's like, you know, these guys that go out with their microphones to a crime scene where a mother's just lost her children, sticks it in her mouth and says, tell me, how do you feel? You know, those people are very lucky if they don't get that microphone wrapped around their neck. There's a time and place for everything. Even in places where I write on a weekly basis, or at least try to, there's a rule of limits, you know, that says when we talk about someone who has just passed, whether we agree with them or not, we do not disparage them or disrespect them in their death. We give time for the families to grieve because that's on us. That's not on them. That's something we choose to do as a community. And if you betray that trust, we remove you from the community because it's that much of an offense that we think that's worthy. Anybody who would willingly do that is not a person we would want to have as a member of our community. We choose that. It's a closed private community, and we get to set the rules, and those are the rules we set, and one of them is a matter of time. When you lose someone to death, you know, at death, all crimes are settled. It's real simple. It doesn't matter that they may affect you or your constituency or that something that you believe in or your country for years to come, okay? When they die is not the time to poke a hole at their corpse. We just don't do it. We don't allow it to be done. And there was a fair amount of that was done regarding the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the 35th President of the United States. It's also true that a very large majority of people in this country were not alive during the years that he was president. Therefore, they don't have a clear indication of what it is that was lost. They also don't have a really good idea of what it was that became from the legacy that some detractors would have him make of his presidency, but they heard some of it yesterday, and they've ignited passions that have long been dead because of settled scores that somebody else has decided to peel the scab off of for their own purposes, and that this was the Washington Post doing it was a terrible deed, and it was absolutely untoward and disrespectful, something that I admired, you know, that I would not even allege the Post capable of until it happened. And in that case, then I have to even have a lower opinion of the reporting and the writing at the Washington Post, because the Washington Post is well known as a paper representing the side with whom I most often disagree with things, and a lot of their reporters, I think, shouldn't be able to use the term reporter. That's just on me. That's how I feel about the Washington Post. They're a strong newspaper with a strong distributorship, with a strong online presence, and one of their young writers decided that he was going to go into the history files and, you know, drag up untrue, misfounded, unfounded arguments against the President of the United States and January of 1963, and propel that argument back onto the front pages of the Washington Post, and I can tell you that they did that for two reasons. First was to disrespect the president, and second was to get ratings for that day. They didn't have enough ratings for that day because it was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. If they had printed his name and his picture and the date of his birth and death, they would have increased their readership the same amount as this nefarious article did, which online was not much because a lot of people found it to be highly, highly offensive, as did I, and they said so, as did I. And, you know, we depend on our newspapers even today, as we did then, to be the arbiters of truth. And it's amazing to me that the Washington Post would drag up such nefarious articles and incidences from the past and try to make out like it was the truth, when even the most cursory historian among us would know that what they said was in fact not true, that is to say false. Yet they printed it anyway, because, I don't know, you tell me. They haven't given me a decent answer. They certainly didn't pull the article down, I know that. They didn't retract anything. They didn't even apologize for the seriousness of the event, even had their article had facts in it, which it did not. They refused to apologize for having run the article on the day they ran it. And, you know, that says a lot to me about the Washington Post, that they would hide and wait to snipe on the dead 50 years after their death, harming the living survivors of that family who did nothing to deserve it. It's just remarkable to me. It's absolutely, you know, there used to be ongoing, never-ending complaints about yellow journalism, tainted journalism, biased journalism. And there was a few cases where, like in the Inquirer, for instance, you could count on certain things showing up in a certain way. But in the Washington Post and the New York Times, no. They used to be pretty much committed to absolute journalism. And they're not anymore. And that's evidenced by the way that the Washington Post, at least for the Washington Post, will ever remain in my mind, is how it celebrated the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the 35th President of the United States. And they can all go to hell for all I care. If anybody has any questions on that, you can call and write and let me know. But I won't change my view. Now, you'll get a second shot to do that because this show's going to replay on Tuesday night beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific time on Netroots Radio. It's certainly available for archive anytime, day or night, at the Coffee Party USA site on Blog Talk Radio. It will be on iTunes under the PPTS flag. So there's no reason that you can't at least listen to what I'm saying. If you have a disagreement with, you certainly have the right to contact me. You can contact me via the blog that the show supports at dailycoast.com/PPTS. You can write me at the TennesseeProgressive@gmail.com. You can go to any of the sites where this show is available and make a comment. I suggest that, you know, failing your ability to do that on the air today, you at least take yourself and make yourself available to the resources you have and email me or make a comment. Love to hear from you. Love to hear from you. And maybe we can start a conversation that way. I don't know. What I do know is that we have a serious set of issues that we've dealt with so far on this journey in the battle of hunger, and I can recommend any of our previous three shows to you if you want an update on that to get the basics down. Our next show is going to be on a different subject. We're going to talk about the battle of education, and we're going to talk about that because it is the second most common area of victimization for the poor in America today. We've started with what I believe to be the first most important battle, and that is the battle of hunger. I hope that you will continue to comment on that, and if you want to come on our airways and talk about it, you're perfectly welcome to do so. We ask that you do so in the coffee party way, and that is that you come play nice, talk on our airways if you were standing in the middle of your grandmother's minister's house, and secondly, that you come prepared. If you have an opinion, stated as such, you can say whatever you want to. If you're trying to represent fact, bring them, because we will support our own show with every fact that is necessary. And if you tell me that it was daylight on, you know, at 5:30 on December 22nd, 1908, I'm going to look. And I can do that while you're talking. I have a research team of 14 people that will do it for me, because when we're on the air, they're at work. And they're fact-checking every single word that comes out, both yours and mine. And when they tell me that I've blown it and made a mistake, it's usually well enough time that's on the air. You know, when I make it, I'll be on the air when I correct it. and it may go another week. It usually doesn't. It's usually instantaneous because my researchers are that good. They're dedicated to the purpose of progressive movement and progressive politics, and they believe in the activities, activists, and activism of the progressive movement across the United States. Their opportunity to support that with factual research and topical research and things like that that help me in the show, when I say that I've got the facts, you can believe me, I do. I've usually got a stack of them sitting here that I'm going to use in the show. Our producer has a list of all the fact sheets that we use, and generally they're available to anyone for any show. All you have to do is ask for the fact sheets on show number or title. That goes back to our first show, because we keep those things. And it's solely for the purpose of our desire to be accurate, not necessarily correct. If we say that the facts are, then that's what we had before us, and we fact-checked our facts. We don't single-check facts anywhere. If the Department of Labor Statistics says that this percentage was unemployed last week, we go three other places to determine that that's true, and we don't use their resources to do it. We use our own. Same with our special guests. We choose special guests because they are leaders in the field, and I hope that you have seen that through our shows and through our things in the past, that we are able to do that, that we do it. We do it on a big basis, and we will always be there for you, no matter what, to do it, okay? You can depend on our facts. The question then becomes, using these facts, we challenge you to take, you know, if you really want to, if you disagree with us wholeheartedly, please feel free to check our facts. We present no facts on this show that we have no confidence in. We don't say it because somebody else said it. We say it because five people have said it, or 10 people, or 100 people, or the most responsible agencies of government, the nonpartisan ones, or, you know, if we say that such-and-so company, we've talked to such-and-so company and given them a chance to be on air to refute our facts. We find that our facts are usually substantial enough that people care not to refute them. That's what we try to provide to the progressive movement, to the coffee party, to those networks that we play on or replay on. We want people to know that they can depend on what we say here. And it's a slow process, and sometimes we make mistakes. When we make mistakes, we are the first ones to admit them and to correct them. We have no problem doing that whatsoever. In fact, we depend on you to help us do that. So if you find something to be incorrect, don't be afraid to come and tell us about it. Write us a note. Send a comment to the show archive. Send a note to me at TennesseeProgressive@gmail.com, and I will be the first one to correct any misstatement of fact that I find, that you find, that I can validate. Okay? That's one of our promises. You can depend on what we say. And in those instances where we make a mistake or a misrepresentation, I guarantee you in the first place it's unintentional because of the work we go to verify everything we say and do here on this show. If it's a mistake our guests have made, send it to us and we will forward it to them and we will correct it on the air. We want you to be able to depend on everything you hear on this show. You know when it's my opinion because I tell you so. And if it's a statement of fact, you can guarantee that I have sufficient fact to back it up, and those are available for your purposes as well because we have a fact sheet for every show we've ever done. And we make those available to anybody who asks them, who has an email address. And if you don't like that much of it and you'd like to do something else, then we invite you to spend some time on our air and tell us about it. Because the final answer comes from you, but the question comes from this show. What are you going to do about it? And coming to you from south and left of Nashville, Tennessee for the last 2 hours, I have been the Tennessee Progressive. I'd like to thank our co-producer and our show host, Progressive Patty, and our team of researchers under Progressive Becky and her team. And we want you to know that we're here every week live from 2 to 4 Central Time to take your calls, to interact with you. We're always available for replay. Like, for instance, this Tuesday evening at 9 p.m. Pacific time, you can tune into netrootsradio.com, and you can call in the show, during the show, or you can have an open chat with us during our replay at Netroots, because we have a chat room there as well that is always open. We've tried chat room here for replay, but we find that it doesn't work as well. So we go to where the live replay is, and that's at NetRoots Radio on Tuesday at 9 p.m. Pacific time till 11 p.m. Pacific time, which is midnight Eastern time. And we like the overnight shift because that's when we think two-thirds of the American people are listening to us. And we look forward to hearing from you. And if this week you will be able to answer one question, let it be this. Let it be the question, what are you going to do about it? Tell me what you're going to do about it. Tell me how you're doing it. Bring your resources. Bring your people. Bring your cause. Bring your issue. Bring your candidacy. Bring your campaign. Tell me what you're doing about it, and we will support that no matter what it is, okay? Unless, of course, it's Stop PPTS, in which case we probably will not support you. But we will at least provide balance for you. So that's not a problem. And we look forward to seeing you next week at the same time. You can always catch this show live at 3 p.m. Eastern or noon Pacific time on Sunday afternoon for 2 hours. Our live chat room is open during that time. Our live phone lines are open during that time. And we look forward to seeing you for the coffee party for NetRoots Radio and for the Progressive Politics Tennessee Style. I am the Tennessee Progressive. Have a great week. Go out and make a difference. Be safe. We'll see you next time, okay? Bye-bye.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there. You'll either be a Union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? My daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son. He'll be with you fellow workers until this battle's won. Tell me, which side are you on? Be a man. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on? Which side are you on? To you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Tell me, which side are you on?